Buenos días y bienvenidos a la charla con Ketil Bjørnstad. En realidad para mí es de una felicidad absoluta poderlo entrevistar por varias circunstancias que están alrededor de esta entrevista. Y antes de iniciar el diálogo, quiero hacer una pequeña aclaración. Traigo las preguntas escritas por Solidaridad de Gremio con las traductoras simultáneas y hemos hecho un acuerdo de que mi emoción no me lleve a leer las preguntas demasiado rápido para que ellas también puedan traducírselas a ustedes de la mejor manera posible. Entonces, empezamos. Welcome, Ketil, to Colombia.
Thank you very much.
And as I said in this introduction, I'm really, really, really excited to present you here in the Hague Festival, because for me you are an outstanding fiction writer from the new Norwegian literature, and you are a poet, you are a musician, and for me you are a kind of a Renaissance artist living in the 21st century. Born in 1952 in Oslo, Mr. Bjørnstad is the author of more than 20 novels, several books of poems and essays, a music and literary critic, biographer of Edvard Munch and Liv Ullmann, with more than 30 records of solo piano and collaborations with jazz and rock musicians. Besides that, he is the composer of several soundtracks for films by directors as Leopold, Ken Loach, and Marie Mieville, and Madame Mieville's husband, Jean-Luc Godard. In a few words, a cultural prodigy. His novel, To Music, translated into Spanish as A la Música by Carmen Freixat, was published by Juntando Palabras in Spain last September. To Music got the French Reader's Prize and was nominated in 2010 to the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. It's a great book about the competitive and sometimes hard world of those who aim for perfection in artistry of piano performance. The landscape that the author paints in the book is a dream or a nightmare come true, a story possible to any music student and particularly to any piano student. Those students could be the future Glenn Goulds, Vladimir Horowitz's or Martha Argerich's of the international concert halls, but the road to that future is long and difficult. Its main character, young Axel, 15 years old, lives with his parents and Catherine, his teen sister. The family and the battlefield of music are like parallel worlds to Axel and to other characters living around the same teen dilemmas. How to survive the traumas that they inherit from their families, perhaps as concert hall virtuosi or at least as decent human beings. I need guidance, says Axel. Everybody needs guidance, but I'm also severely in need of courage. To Music could be read as the training of the youngsters to adulthood by their parents and teachers, in some cases with cruelty and tyranny. One of the most dramatic moments in the novels is when Rebecca Frost, a beloved member of the Young Pianist Society, makes her debut. When she enters the stage, says Axel, she trips. It happens on the stairs that descend to the lowest platform where the grand piano awaits. She steps on her own dress, tumbling forwards. The hall gasps. We cannot believe our eyes. Rebecca Frost is suddenly prostrate on the floor. Somebody screams. So, Mr. Bjørnstad, you made your debut with the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra in 1969 when you were 16 years old, and you played the Bartok Piano Concerto number 3. How do you feel at the time before and after the concert? And I want to know if by chance To Music is a kind of remembrance of that time.
Yes, in a way it is close to what I experienced as a young pianist myself. And I remember especially playing for the first time with a really distinguished orchestra. It made you full of respect in one way, but also it was my guys there. I knew those people. I knew the oboe player sitting. I said hello to him and felt, you know, it's something special with youth. It is this combination of being totally vulnerable and also having sometimes too much courage. What I remember especially from when I was 16 years old was that I actually didn't begin to practice the second movement of Bartok before 2 or 3 weeks before the concert. And now I'm thinking I must have been insane because, you know, how did I get that kind of self-confidence? Yeah. I felt, okay, the second movement, it's beautiful, I know, I will manage. So, what I remember best is this very special vulnerable, and I was, of course, very nervous. And my professor was sitting in the audience, and everything was big in a way, but also you have this feeling that sometimes disappear later in life.
And that was a full house, like in the Rebecca Frost concert in the novel?
You know, the Rebecca Frost sequence is actually built on a story from one of my beloved teachers, an old wonderful lady called Amalie Christie. She was the grand old lady of teaching for me in Norway. She told me that one of her colleagues came into the stage and having her first recital as a pianist and suddenly fall down because it was a long, beautiful robe. Mm. Beautiful. And she wasn't able to do the concert. She had to go and tell the audience, I lost my concentration. I can't do it. And I can understand that. It's like a sports performer as well, that you have so much energy, you are so focused on what you are going to do, and if suddenly you are totally ruined, it's for some people very difficult to start over again.
Yeah. Thinking about her debut, Rebecca says to Axel in the novel, I have no good explanation for what I did, but I remember all those afternoons as I sat practicing after school. I remember the lonely hours, the aching back. I remember all the time it took up, and I thought, is this really worth it? Mm. And for what? To what purpose? At what price? Am I doing this because I'm mad enough to believe I can give the world a revolutionary new version of Beethoven Opus 109? Am I doing because I love music more than anything, because I need to surround myself with it, to slog at it for 5 or more hours a day? Or am I doing it because I want to be famous? Rebecca's dilemma suggests for me an obvious question, maybe. What is, in your experience, the price that must be paid for perfection in artistry?
The price to be paid? Yeah. You know, that's similar to so many hard things in life, I think. It's not only music, but some people get in touch with so challenging things to do in life that they really have to sacrifice a lot. It always touches me to see how different life is for many of us. Some people are easy living all the time. They also have a lack of drama in their lives. They have no early deaths. They just live and live in a kind of happiness. Mm-hmm. Other people are experiencing big drama very early. They could lose their mother, 5 or 6 years old. They could be in trouble, be sick, whatever. And I think when you get in love with music and you understand that you really want to perform, you are not in the beginning able to understand how difficult it is actually, how much you have to devote yourself for the rest of your life to be a performer, to practice, to say no to many, many things. But, you know, as I bring into the book, this Rubinstein quotation I love. And he said once to his pupils, don't practice too much. Life is too short. You have so much other things to experience in life. You have books to be read. You have to meet women. You have to drink your wine. You have to live. So he tried to tell, as a grandmaster, that there is a limit for everything. But I have experienced how this generation I was a part of now have been replaced by younger people with much, much more expectations to perform, to have a huge repertoire, to be totally technically brilliant. So it's harder now than any time, I think.
But don't you think that the Rubinstein's case is, he was a bon vivant. And that is a very good lesson for piano players in the battlefields of classical music?
That it's a good advice?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. But you know, that there is so much that is tradition. A very famous Norwegian pianist called Leif Ove Ansnes, he discussed with me once and also with many people, why do we have to play by heart all the time? If we could use the scores, we could have been playing much, much more music. Mm-hmm. But you know, there is a standard. You don't go to the podium and play Brahms' second piano concerto having the score. No one would take you seriously. You can do it when it's chamber music. Mm. That's allowed. Mm. But even that you have to play by heart, without the score, it makes things so hard, so much extra work you have to do to get totally into the music. Yeah.
Okay. And what about the stage fright? What can you tell us about, as Axel says in the novel, this huge beast, the audience? How do you handle that beast?
You know, it's like, in this room, exactly now, everyone have an opinion about the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And it's not you alone that are setting the atmosphere, and it's not me alone, not you. It is something, interaction, it's something happening. It's always, as a musician, very interesting to listen to the silence, because the silence is not one single thing. Silence is many different things. Silence can be total silence, close to frightening silence. Then you can feel a magic thing happens. Silence can also be a kind of boring silence, that people are silent but bored. Yeah. And what actually happens between, it's like, I say often, it's like what's happening between an author and a reader. It's the same magic thing, because the book itself is not able to be understood without the reader. It's nothing without the reader. Yeah. The book only for the author is nothing. Then you could, yeah.
But actually, as maybe remembering John Cage, mm-hmm. Silence is another kind of music too. For example, when you tell me this morning the story in the when you played with that sound of the sea. You remember that? Can you tell us that story too? To talk about silence.
What you said, the
story that you told me before we came here about the concert that you gave in Manila, maybe or something like that. In the when you heard a very strange silence, like a contrast when you play piano and the exterior sound. Do you remember?
No, that we talked about now? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, before we came here.
Yeah, the special silence.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, no, but you know, it can happen whenever you expect. You don't always know, but as a classical musician, you always have to play the same score. if you play Brahms number two, you have to play Brahms number two. And even if people are like me now, a little bit struggling with my throat, you can't avoid that. When you are a jazz musician, as I feel more free now to improvise, you can change the concert after what is the atmosphere in the room. And that's also very interesting, that you can suddenly change your mind and you can say, well, I don't play this piece, I play something very different. That is fascinating, I think. But for a classical musician, you always have to deliver whatever the atmosphere in the audience is, actually.
Yeah. Let's talk about, for example, routine in music. Mm. When you listen in A Silent Way by Miles Davis, that record was released in 1969. Jazz was a must in your life. So jazz, classical music, poetry, novels, are those different ways to escape from routine?
From routine, yes, it's a way of escape, but I hope it's more, to escape could be something negative, but I hope it's also to try to come closer to something. Mm-hmm. All these are expressions of human kind. It is important for us to live, I think, to understand what is fascinating is how much we need it. Why are we sitting here today? Because literature is important for us, and also music is important for us. Mm-hmm. And it's not always so easy to describe why it is important, but we have to live with it. So I think, for me, recognizing the jazz music, it was more or less because Oslo in the late 60s was a fantastic capital both for classical music and for jazz music. Mm. And many fantastic artists came to perform in something called Club 7. And I was walking from the big concert hall, the Aula, where the Nobel Peace Prize is always delivered, was in the former days. And under the sun of Edvard Munch, talked about. And going to this club, this dark club, where you can listen to jazz musicians. And I loved this change of atmosphere. Okay. And I loved so much the freedom of expression in the jazz music.
Mm-hmm. Everybody in the novel Into Music is looking for a center of gravity. But sadly, as it can be, most of the characters lost that center of gravity. Mm. For example, Axel finds that center in music. His mother too, but she loses it to alcohol, and she tries to forget her miserable life. Mm. Axel's sister Catherine tries to. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
No problem.
Well, as I said, Axel's sister Catherine tried to find that center in sex. The torch-like man, that is a very dark character in the novel, is full of expectations in the telling of his daughter, but her debut concert is a failure. And Selma Lynch, the great pianist teacher, retired from concert life, discovers that center of gravity in their pupils. In any case, music is a salvation, but also could be a frustration.
Yes.
Do you agree, and why, or why not, that art is the better way to improve reality?
Yeah. You know, it is interesting how much art is built on loss and suffering. I think if you look at what is written, look at the writers and look at the musicians performing and the composers. So many of them are unhappy persons. There was a professor in Norway who studied the Nobel Prize winner of literature, and he found that up to more than 80% of them had big alcohol problems, and many of them had nervous breakdowns. It was a very special result this professor came to. And when you look at a man like Schubert, Beethoven, so many of the big composers, they were unhappy people. Yeah. And I feel it's interesting to see how we are stretching towards something beautiful, something honest that art can deliver to us. And despite actually all the losses and the suffering, and this book is a little bit about that. Yeah. It's a little bit about how people are suffering and trying anyway to make something meaningful out of it.
And in jazz music, for example, Bud Powell, Charlie Parker, Billie Holiday.
Then you have the whole gallery.
Okay? Yeah. And can we think maybe that art is also a way to defeat that in a certain way? Mm. What do you think? To defeat that?
To defeat it. You know, I think that it's difficult. Of course, you can use art as therapy, and I have deep respect for people doing that. Having, for instance, people creating music for really suffering people in the psychological treatments, for instance. I have never experienced that myself, so I can't talk too much about it. But you can. I don't think that if a person suddenly understands how to express something deep from inside him or herself, it's very difficult to control it, to build a kind of a framework that is very, very easy to be inside, to be very controlled. I don't know too many very, very controlled people in this business, actually.
Okay. The characters in the novel are also young and beautiful, at least the pianist, the youngsters.
Yes.
And their bodies are in their splendor, contrary to the bodies of their parents, the old and tired. Eroticism is a way to survive the pressure of adults in the novel, too. Can we think that the music is also a novel about the body? For example, the body to play music, to love, to feel, to suffer?
Yeah, of course, and when you are a young person, you have so many levels. You can experience the sensuality, I think, the sensuality of music. One professor once told me, isn't it strange that very young people sometimes plays music that express the knowledge of a long life? For instance, those young people playing the late sonatas of Beethoven. Mm-hmm. Beethoven was never an old man, but he was in the end of his life, on the end of his life cycle when he wrote this music. He had experienced very much. And how is it that we are sitting as 18 years old listening to a Mahler symphony and thinking he had the heart disease, he was close to dying, it was so much knowledge of the cruelty of life. And the young people, we love it. I remember I loved Mahler from the first time when I was young. Mm-hmm. So how is it that we are lending experiences to each other, delivering experiences, telling, this is something I experienced. Can you feel something in common with this? And surprisingly often people say yes. And that's also interesting, I think, when you write about very special things. My novel was actually inspired by Haruki Murakami and his novel Norwegian Wood.
Norwegian Wood.
Yeah, because it is about young students in Tokyo in the late 60s. And I thought, when a person can let those people so far away from me, from Tokyo in the late 60s, come so close. Perhaps I could try in this novel to write about things I knew about in the same period, the classical music, and that someone could feel we have something in common, even if we live very different lives. It could be also a person that totally ignores music, I hope could find something in common with what the people are thinking in this novel.
Yeah. And is music classical or rock or jazz music, but in the case of the novel, it's a road to independence, in the battle for a generation at the end of the 60s against the adults that continuously frustrate the illusions of their sons or of their daughters or pupils?
You know, much of this story is a book about what has been a struggle in my own life, and that is how do we choose between the false and the true authorities in life? When you are a child, how can you find out this teacher is bad for me or this teacher is very good for me? You have no. You have only yourself to trust. And I myself had to really be kind of a rebellion sometimes and say, no, I don't want to follow this. I had one teacher telling me, you have to do exactly as I say. Don't think, just do what I say. And I was thinking, this is impossible for me. I'm perhaps not old enough to understand everything, but you cannot tell me not to think myself. So I have always, Leonard Bernstein once talked about the big difference between, for instance, Fritz Reiner of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the famous Fritz Reiner, who always was very, very, very demanding, and he didn't allow too much thinking. He wanted full control. And then he had other conductors, like George Sell. He loved Bernstein himself. I couldn't go to Reiner. I had to avoid him, he said. I had to find another professor to give me, to encourage me, to love music. And I felt that I lost the love for music with one teacher. So I had to quit and I said, sorry, I can't follow you anymore. I have to go to another person. And suddenly the love for music came back again.
There's a fragment when Miss Lynch, the piano teacher, says that Glenn Gould could be a bore. It's a very funny one, that the fragment, and that he was a cerebral musician all the time, bursting ideas all the time, with ideas all the time. He gets manic, exaggerated, and frightening. She says to good Axel. Can you imagine, says Miss Lynch, can you imagine a woman wanting to go to bed with Glenn Gould? Horrendous. Glenn Gould is a brute. Compare him to Martha Argerich. The two are worlds apart. What kind of worlds apart are those?
My opinion, my personal opinion.
Yeah, your
opinion.
Personal one.
No, but you know, I loved Martha Argerich from the first. I remember when her first recording came to Norway, you know, a whole generation was totally thrilled by her. Totally thrilled. And she came to perform up in the cold north in Oslo, the capital of Norway, and we adored her. She was strong, passionate, and also had the control, you know. I love Glenn Gould, of course I do, but he always had a kind of cerebral approach that made you must have a special way of understanding him, I think, always. What is really touching with Gould is that he has so many hidden secrets. When he suddenly sits down and conducts Wagner's Siegfried Idyll for the small chamber orchestra, then I break into tears, because that's so incredibly beautiful, mm-hmm. and so different from what he always did. But he withdrew, and you could ask, he was actually accused for withdrawing because he didn't have technique good enough to be on the top level. That was some New York critics telling. He was very vulnerable for that. It could be true, actually, that he wanted to sit down, concentrate on the music, not knowing that you have to play Schumann with Chicago next week, and the next week, then again, you have to play Brahms with Philadelphia Orchestra. You have to go to Boston to play Beethoven. All those things he could control. And I think music should be perhaps more like that, not a show-off, that you can always play a huge repertoire, but to be a little bit slower and humble.
Okay. And can't you tell us also about, for example, the differences and affinities between music and literature in your work?
It is so fascinating still today. I will die without knowing what is actually the big difference. It is so difficult. It's so different to create it. When you create music, especially when you are on stage improvising, you're very fast into the communication. Everyone here knows after 3 or 4 single tones if you like the music or not. You can feel, oh, this is fantastic, or no, I hate it, I have to leave. In literature, you can struggle with a novel for 200 pages and you don't even know if you like the book yet, but you still continue perhaps, and when you have read it, you found out, I love it, but it has some faults as well. Edvard Munch once said that this picture could be perfect. It only lacks some real big errors to be really genius. So it's like, I think for me, what is fascinating with literature is that it is so abstract, not invisible as the music is, because the music is so invisible. You only have to listen to it. The words are much more concrete in a way, but the result, you know, you are struggling for some rhythmical, for some expressions, and in the novel you have always so many of the same possibilities as a creator of the symphonies. I think you have the dynamics, you have really the dynamics of life coming into the art.
And you talk about the invisible. What about to work in films, soundtrack films?
I love to do that. And that is, of course, my admiration for film. As I know you are a film critic. Yeah. I grew up with also some film makers who learned me to discover. The novel Vague of France. It was the same time as Antonioni made his. It was fascinating to be young in the 60s, because so much happened at that time in art, and so much many expressions was renewed, and it was a high energy. I think composing for film is to respect the director very much. You have to listen to the director, what he or she demands, what she or he wants you to express. So you are under a regime in a way. You have a framework, but inside that you have so many possibilities to put your colors into it. And I think when film music succeeds, it is important for the film also.
How was your work with Godard?
No, I have the feeling no one works with Godard. He works with other people. He is the master. He picks up. Actually, this is my privilege to be a part of ECM recording company in Germany. And Godard has a relationship with the producer Manfred Eicher that is very strong. They are making remixes sometimes, those two guys, of music already presented, to make it become a new music for film. And that's a privilege. So I feel, I think it must be like working with Ingmar Bergman, that it was Bergman all, Liv Ullmann once told me that. In a way, he said to her, "You, Liv, you are my Stradivarius." And you know, the big masters of film, they are so, they have so full control that not the actors, not the musician, no one could do very much actually to change what is already decided.
Let's talk about again about Glenn Gould. Mm-hmm. Selma Lynch also says in the novel that Glenn Gould was so close to the music that he never allows himself the distance to communicate the things he wants. So let's talk about another artistic dilemma. What is the distance between the musical score and the performer? For example, as happens with jazz standards. Different according every standard to the performer. Is the music in the score or in the performer who gives life to the note?
That's a philosophical question.
Yes.
You should answer.
That's the last one.
You should answer it. It's interesting. You know, what is fascinating is when you understand that you can give something personal into the score. You can do that as a classical musician easily as well. You have your limits, but you know you can put the tempo slightly slower, slightly faster. You can, having this phrase, you can do so much actually. I think the balance should be the respect for what was originally written. I was in the Norwegian Opera on Tuesday and saw the fantastic Christoph Willibald Gluck, Orpheus, and Eurydice, and I had to leave in the intermission. I couldn't stand it, because then it was the director. He had so much he wanted to say. He made a totally modern scenario. He totally showed deep, for me, this is very subjective, deep disrespect for what is the music about, what is the story about. It was an ice-cold experience, and I was thinking, this man is going too far away. It's like when you are putting a play by Ibsen up on the stage and you can't recognize it because the director wants to give so much of himself. I think there is a balance, and there is actually a moral balance. You have to, if a person have tried to deliver something, you should listen to what is actually the original meaning here. If you're going too far away from that, why can't you make a totally new play yourself, actually?
And, another amazing Norwegian writer, Lars Saabye Christensen, said about to music, "It must have been both joyful as well as painful writing it." So, Mr. Bjørnstad, how joyful and how painful was it for you to write the novel?
It was a mixture. You know, Lars is a close friend of mine, and we were going to church together when we were young, living in the same area. And he told me that he expected me to write this story because he knew about my concert pianist career when we were young both. And he said, perhaps it was too close to you that you could write it before you were close to 50 years old. And that happened, because when I was close to 50, I understood, now I can see the end of my life. I can come there, but I cannot do everything I expected to do in life. And then suddenly I listened to this story and I understood, now it's time to write this story. Mm. It's not autobiographical in the inner, in the outer way of everything, but it has very much with me to do, actually. And it's a joy to find the story, but it's painful to write it, I have to say, because it's much sorrow in it. It's much loss in it.
And to have a flavor of your writing, can you read us an excerpt of the novel?
Yes, we talked about, you found something for me that...
Yes.
I shall try to read then from the page 43 in the English edition. And Synnestvedt is one of those teachers we talked about earlier that was easy, not the most terrible man. I love those people that are not too terrible. I sit and play the piano until late every afternoon and visit Synnestvedt each Wednesday, who tells me I'm making huge progress. Synnestvedt, in his grimy little flat in Sorgenfrigata, filled with grease everywhere. The grease of old rak fish and sylte from countless Christmas eves spent alone with his sister. Doesn't anybody ever come to do his cleaning? The ivory keys on the worn out Blüthner grand piano are sticky and black from the grubby fingers of his pupils. Synnestvedt, the friendly, lovable loser who never dared to make a debut himself, who is stupid enough to believe that I still go to school. A mediocre piano teacher, an appalling pianist, a fact he reveals each time he tries to demonstrate something technical. I have overtaken him by light years already. He tries to offer me guidance, inept interpretation, an overly sentimental voice. A man with too many photographs of himself on his grand piano, with virtually nothing to teach, afflicted with dandruff, dry airways, and a palling breath, he nonetheless has a surprisingly stimulating effect on me. He gives me space, allows me to take on the biggest challenges and to set myself impossible goals, such as playing Brahms' B major concerto with the Philharmonic before I reach 20. It is all mother's fault. The money she gave me, little tokens of encouragement, because my first piano teacher was so dreadful. Fru Holtemann at Heggeli, near the cemetery, with bouquets up her nose, grimy hands, always suffering with the cold and with the cloying smell that came from the thick, worn-out wallis she wore even in summer. I shiver every time I remember her, how she stood behind me, sneezing into my hair as she forced me to hammer out those ghastly, churny etudes, the odor of death, perspiration, and meringues. After 3 awful years with Fru Holtermann, mother found Synnestvedt. The best that can be said of Synnestvedt is that he is kind, has a liking for Schumann, drinks port in secret, and worships the Latin American pianist Claudio Arrau as much as I do. There's something he would like to emulate in that imposing masculinity, the thin black mustache, the aroma of cigars, unattainable dreams. Synnestvedt is pale, skinny, and narrow-shouldered. Synnestvedt is a stopgap in my life, a piano teacher who can teach me nothing, with not one secret of how to improve my technique or strengthen my interpretation power. A disconcerting fact, since I'm not that good. Even I need guidance. Everybody needs guidance. But I am also severely in need of courage. And Synnestvedt cheers me on every Wednesday for the big competition in November, the young people's piano competition. Since he has no idea I've dropped out of school, he doesn't know how vital this is for me. The competition could even be a major breakthrough. That snooty 16-year-old George Fredrik Salvesen from Rykkinn won last year. The guy who always had a drip coming from his snub nose when he plays, a chap with barely a modicum of talent, but who slipped through the eye of the needle and ended up playing Mozart on the TV, all thanks to the competition. The Young People's Piano Competition is the great autumn event held every year in the aula, the great university hall with Edvard Munch's The Sun as the backdrop. The aula is known to us all since we've all visited it so often, not least with international pianists having made guest appearances here. This is the hall where the Nobel Peace Prize is presented every 10th of December. Rubinstein, Richter, Gilels, and Arau have all played here. Askenazy has pronounced the Steinway that stands in the aula one of the world's best. Georg Fredrik Salvesen was ecstatic when he won. I sat in the hall clapping, even though I wanted to leave. I knew I could play better than him. Salvesen was a flash in the pan. He would soon realize it himself, give the piano up and study engineering. Winning would be easy if, I thought, if the standards were that low. It made me more certain that I could succeed the next year.
Okay, I think that the music must be read in every music conservatory and music academy to learn about the art in which you are, Mr. Bjørstad, as I said at the beginning of this talk, a Renaissance artist in the 21st century. That's a privilege for us. So thank you so much, and please join me in giving a hand to this marvelous artist, please. Tenemos 10 minutos para preguntas.
English or Spanish? Okay. I am a big fan of your work with ECM, with David Darling. Are you listening?
Yes. You speak in English?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of your work, your ECM work, and I've seen a very deep connection with the water. Yeah. So I wanted to know, how did you manage to express all these feelings? Because when I listen to your music, I can see this deep connection with the ocean, especially. It's very atmospheric, very spacious. So, and also, for example, the drumming of John Christensen, that it's very atmospheric. So I wanted to know, what do you think about that?
Thank you. Perhaps since I lived by a small island for 16 years outside, it is 3 hours away from Oslo. It is impossible to come to the mainland without having a boat. And I could hear the ocean all the time. The sound of the ocean was with me for 16 years. And the autumn storms, as well as the silent summer evenings, I understood that the rhythm of the water is sometimes very similar with music. What we try to express in music is sometimes expressed in the water surrounding us. And I have to admit that it was Manfred Eicher of SEM who made me aware of that. I didn't myself use the water metaphor too much, but he said, why don't you call this music the sea? And from then, when he, or water stories, the first one, I understood that he was very right, that the water has some abstract elements that is similar to music. And it made me more easy to be into that way of thinking when I created the music. And as you mentioned, the master, Jon Christensen, the way he plays is really like, yeah, it's very close to the, those feelings you get when you try to express what water is. Thank you for the question.
Usted ha hablado mucho de del centro de gravedad. ¿Qué significa para usted el centro de gravedad y el tambor? Gracias.
Yes, yes, thank you. That's a very interesting question. Yeah, you know, the drums is something I am always longing to work with. If I work with a very gifted drummer, he or she is setting so much of the gravity of the music itself. I worked with Marilyn Masur, the percussionist, the female fantastic percussionist. Last summer we made a recording that will come for ACM, and I understood after the concert how much the influence of the drum does. It makes the basic, and when you are not performing with the drums, you have to try to find the drum inside, the drummer inside yourself, actually.
Do you have a physical or spiritual grove of alder trees in your life, the way the main character did, a place to go for thought and refuge?
A spiritual?
Either spiritual or actual place, the alder trees.
Okay, can you repeat the question, please?
Yes, the main Aunt Axel would go to the grove of alder trees
yes.
near where his mother died.
Yes.
Do you have an actual or spiritual place that you go for that same?
Yes, I understand. Yes. Yes, I always try to find that wherever I am living on earth, and you know, nature, I think, is doing so much in our understanding. I need this. Sorry. I definitely have a spiritual place in the nature. Always find it. Always had it. It could be like Axel in the forest, surrounded by trees. It could be out close to the ocean. And I will always seek nature. I lived in the center of Paris for 2 years. And in the center of Paris, even I also find those spiritual places where the nature in the combination with the civilization is playing positively together. It's very important for me. I think it's very important for everyone trying to create. Thank you for the question.
Una última pregunta antes de la firma de libros que tirará en la mesa a la salida del auditorio.
I wanted to know if you have a connection with the design of the albums, of the musical albums, especially from ECM, that are so, I feel there's a big connection with your music also. The whole design.
Yeah. No, I wrote an article about it in a book called Winful Windfall Lights. I recommend that book if you are interested in ECM covers. It is on a Lars Müller publication, Switzerland publication, came out last year, or 2009 perhaps, where I write, because Manfred Eicher is a very close friend. He is my producer. He is a very, very powerful man, really. He can be very, very challenging, very hard to work with, and he can be fantastic to work with. He always wants you the best. That's the most important. About the covers, he is totally dictator himself, and sometimes never tells us, the musicians, at all what we are going to see. I have this new cover now here, the new recording of ECM. It's called Night Song. You can imagine, this is a white cover. I was thinking now, he's coming with something dark, night, blue. And that's typical Manfred Eicher. Totally surprised. This is like birds flying in the air, white cover, and he calls it Night Song. That's ECM.
Okay, thank you so much again. Thank you.